Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Have you ever applied for a visa to visit a European country and got this experience?
So I applied for the visa and it got denied. Reason they stated was they've looked at my documents and my informations are not reliable.
Well, you're not alone. We look at why rejection rates are so high despite applications costing so much money. And African countries move towards floating solar panels to meet energy needs. It's Wednesday, June 26th. First, we look at Somalia and Ethiopia. Border tensions between these two have been escalating for a while now, and it's something we've discussed on our podcast before. The latest is an accusation by Somalia's ambassador to the UN levelled against Ethiopian troops. Ambassador Abubakar Dahil Osman said Ethiopian soldiers illegally crossed into Somalia and confronted local security forces. The rising tension stems from an agreement made in January between Ethiopia and Somaliland, a breakaway region in northern Somalia. Ethiopia agreed to formally recognize Somaliland, and in exchange, Addis Ababa would lease for 50 years some 20 kilometers of coastline along the Red Sea for its naval forces. That arrangement has been strongly opposed by the government in Mogadishu and others like the Arab League, where Somalia is a member and considered an Arab country, but that's a story for another day. To get a better understanding of what's going on, I've been speaking to BBC Somali editor Muhyiddin Roble. And he started by explaining what happened.
On the weekend, from Friday and through last week, we have been receiving information coming from the border between Somalia and Ethiopia, where local residents and local authorities has been reporting some movements and activities made by the Ethiopian Defense Forces. So what happened was that some new Ethiopian military crossed the border into Somalia. And now it seems these forces were not part of the African Union peacekeepers.
These are fresh troops.
Yeah, they are fresh troops. Mm-hmm. So they moved to areas around the border inside Somalia. One of the places that they went was a city in central Somalia called Mataban, which is part of the Hiran region of Somalia. So they are not part of the previous Ethiopian forces that were inside Somalia. They are new, and that's what Somali government is calling the Ethiopian forces coming into country illegally. Mm.
And do we know why they crossed the border, and have you been speaking to authorities in Somalia to understand what happened and what they were doing there?
Ethiopia government has made no comment yet, but when we talk to the Somali government and local authorities, especially the governor of the Mataban district, he told us that he had unexpectedly seen Ethiopian troops, which he said there were between 3,000 to 5,000 soldiers coming into his city. And together with the local security officers, they went and confronted them, not in a conflict way, but to understand why they were here and what they want, trying to stop or to prevent them to come into the center of the city. So what that governor told BBC when I talked to him on the phone was that the commanders that were leading these Ethiopian forces told him they were here to fight against Al-Shabaab. He also told me that they told him their government has already informed the Somali government the movement of Ethiopian troops coming inside Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab. But in that area, there hasn't been an Al-Shabaab basis. That's an area controlled by the government. Mm. So these are what the commanders told the district commissioner. And at the end, it seems they have agreed that the Ethiopian forces go back to where they're from. we believe they still remain inside the Somali territory.
That's very extraordinary if troops from one country can cross into the neighboring country and claim they are there to fight terrorism without the knowledge of the home country. How is extraordinary is that? And how is the Somalian government in Mogadishu, are they taking this kind of event?
Yes, it seems extraordinary, but when it comes to Ethiopian-Somalia situation, it's not unusual. Ethiopia has a history of coming into Somalia with or without the approval of Somali government. And usually Ethiopia have maintained a very political influence of the regional governments inside Somalia, not the federal government sometimes. But what makes it different now is the level of tension between the two countries and the timing of the arrival of these Ethiopian forces. Because a few weeks ago, the national security advisor of the Somali president told the public that they're not happy with the Ethiopia forces' presence in the country and that they have asked the African Union that Ethiopian troops, both those who are part of the African Union peacekeepers and those who are not, to leave the country by the end of this year.
Yes, and that's happening. And at the same time, we've seen Somalia get a non-permanent seat at the UN Security Council. So what kind of effort will the government do in Mogadishu to deal with this? And could we expect an escalation?
Already the Somali ambassador to the UN, Abubakar Bale, has made a speech to the UN Security Council where he was complaining, calling the Ethiopian forces coming into Somalia illegal just this week. Some people say that's the beginning of how the globalization of the conflict between Somalia and Ethiopia and taking it to the UN Security Council at the center of the global stage. But what we have been saying for quite some time and what we've been hearing from the Somali government officers was that they don't really want to escalate the situation. They want to keep things calm because escalating it, as it seems, will not serve good for both countries. Ethiopia plays a big role in keeping Somalia safe, especially it has bases, it has regions where the Ethiopian troops are the main security providers, protecting the local authorities and the civilians from Al-Shabaab. If we look at it by Dabo, which is the major city of southwest state of Somalia. So that whole city relies to Ethiopian troops more than it relies to Somali forces when it comes to that fight against Al-Shabaab. Understanding that situation, and given the fact that Somalia may not now have the army that quickly replace Ethiopian troops, it seems that Somalia doesn't want to escalate the situation. But this is a situation that's not going away either, because we have been seeing senior ministers from Ethiopia making repeatedly statements where they are indicating that they're looking forward to the implementation and the finalization of the memorandum of understanding they made with Somaliland, which opens the door for recognizing Somaliland, a matter that seems the federal government will never accept, regardless how it happens or who does it.
Yeah. Just for the benefit of, you know, for our listeners, Somaliland, why is it that there is no foreign recognition for Somaliland? And you've said they've been self-declared state since 1991, so more than 30 years. Why would they get recognized? Because from what you're saying, they are pretty much at the center of this escalation that we are seeing now.
It's a quite complicated question. But basically, Somaliland has been part of Somalia since 1960. There have been a conflict, for example, in the 1980s, when the armed rebel group from Somaliland been fighting against the government. Somali army have almost destroyed the Hargeisa, which is the capital city of Somaliland. Almost. Too many people have been killed. Hundreds, if not thousands. And since then, the military government in Somalia collapsed in 1991. Somaliland recognized to be an independent state. I think why it didn't get a recognition, that may not be a question I could answer or I could have all the reasons to explain on that. But in my understanding, it seems because of the history between, you know, the two regions that made Somalia, the northern Somalia, which is Somaliland and used to be under the British colony, and South Somalia, which used to be under the Italian colony, given the long history they have, given the African Union Act, which was stopping countries changing the borders or keeping the borders the way the colony has left. With all these reasons and too many other reasons, Somaliland may not get the recognition. But for them, they have been trying it. They made a good relation with Taiwan, which has been helping them. They have a good relation with the Emirates, the UAE, United Arab Emirates. Already they have, you know, Ethiopia embassy there. They still keep relations, diplomatic relation with so many countries, but they did not get the recognition they wanted.
Yeah, so it's a lot of history running very deep, Roble. But in closing then, are we going to see, or do you think we're going to see any international intervention, particularly between what's happening now between Ethiopia and Somalia?
I think the tension between Somalia and Ethiopia, it's making the region much worse. The region has already had enough of conflicts. Look at it, what is happening in Sudan, what is happening inside Ethiopia and many parts of the region. And some of the international communities, including the UN Security Council, have already made a couple of statements where they were asking both sides to remain calm and negotiate and handle their issues diplomatically. But with all the talk, nothing much has happened. So it's unpredicted. It's a situation that could make the region much worse.
Muhyiddin Roble, the BBC Somali editor. Now, for most travelers around the world, the process of applying for a visa to Europe is quite a straightforward one. However, African applicants face more severe restrictions and higher rejection rates than those from other regions. A recent study by UK-based research firm Lego Collective revealed that almost half of the 130 million euros earned by the European Commission from rejected visa applications in 2023 came from applicants living in Africa. Data from the Commission's Migration and Home Affairs shows that West African countries, among them Ghana, Senegal and Nigeria, experienced visa rejection rates of between 40% to 50%. Let's hear from a Nigerian whose applications were rejected, having spent over half a million naira, or over $320 in the process.
My name is Oluchukwu Okeke. I am a social media manager and I'm also a video editor, freelance, not working under any corporation. So the first time I applied for visa, I was freshly out of college. Like, I literally had my last paper, then waiting to have my clearance and the graduation and all. My sister, who is living in Paris, asked me to come for a visit because then it was rumoring around school going on strike, and eventually they went on strike. So I felt, oh, it's a good opportunity to visit my sister staying in Paris while I wait for school to resume, and then I go back and have my graduation party and have my clearance and get my certificate. So I applied for the visa and it got denied. Reason they stated was they've looked at my documents and my informations are not reliable. It was heartbreaking because I've never applied for any visa before and I didn't ever imagine to be denied the visa. I was so excited. This is my only sister. I don't have any other spare anywhere. I was super excited to leave the country for the first time and visit Paris. So they broke my heart that first time. I said, it's okay, it's all good. So I finished school properly. I have my certs now.
Okay, tell us then about the second time that you applied and what happened.
So I decided to look through the first documents to make sure, because you don't get to have a physical interview. They judge you based on your documents that you submit. So you don't even have to talk to anybody. Unlike some other countries, you have to go for physical interviews. So I checked the first documents. I even had to contact an agent to help me check if there was something wrong with my documents that I need to, you know, correct on the second one. Because, I mean, it's still money we lose in making these applications. And then they just, someone from nowhere will just say, I'm not granting this person access. You know, you lose a lot of money. You book all these, make all these reservations, book flight tickets. You know, that even when you get them back, it's not like 100% of what you paid for. So we were careful the second time. I made another application November, December last year, gathered my documents, still went. And after 2 weeks, I got a mail that my passport was ready. So I went to the embassy and it was still the same thing. I saw the rejection letter. It still says they've looked through my documents and my information is not reliable. Like, that's the exact thing from the first one. The same statements written as well on the second one. I was really devastated. And then I had to start asking, because I know a few of my friends that has also been denied visa as well. And one of my elder relatives that applied to the same country, she's going to be going by August. So she's elderly. She's married with kids. She has something she's doing. So she was saying she feels it's because I'm quite young, and they feel when a young person is trying to travel, and then I didn't have like something tangible I was doing, they feel, oh, she's not going to come back. So I feel if they had asked me or something, because they just judge you with your documents and that's it.
Have you given up, or you're still looking forward to be able to travel sometime?
I haven't given up. I'm hoping to apply again for December. I really, really want to go see my sister. I mean, this is the longest I've stayed away from her. I was literally living with her when she was still in Lagos, but she moved to Paris with her family because of work. And this is the longest I've spent without seeing her. So I will apply again during December, and I hope I get it.
Are you able to understand what they say when they say that your documents are inconsistent or anything like that? The reasons that are given you, do you feel you understand those reasons so that you're able to take steps for the next application?
After the first rejection, I had the same rejection statement, and the second one, the same rejection statement. So I forwarded my whole documents to a travel agency, and she was able to see some lapses on my documents. So one of the lapses she saw was a mistake from my hotel reservation. My sister's husband made first hotel reservation. He felt it was too expensive, so he made another reservation with another hotel and forgot to delete the first hotel reservation. So the hotel, so I now had like two hotel reservations. So it's enough for anybody to say, oh, this person is not actually serious with this. You have two hotel reservations. What are you doing? The second thing she saw on my documents that wasn't, you know, making much sense. When I left school, I went into interning in a radio station close to my school. I got employed after a year. So I was interning while I was in school because my school program was weekends. So I was interning in a radio station. So after I graduated, they offered me an employment. So they started paying me. But then the person that was paying me was the manager of the station. The manager of the station pays the workers. The company pays the manager. Then the manager disburses the salary. Sometimes the manager pays from the pocket of the company and, you know, gives accounts however they do it. So the agent was able to say, your salary comes in from a personal bank account and not the company's bank account. So they would feel, oh, you just went to someone and the person is just sending this money to your account. So next time I should be able to make sure it's the company with the company name that I claim to be working with should tally with the credit alerts I get on a monthly tagged salary. So it was said that enough, that alone is enough for them to say, oh, this is not reliable.
Lulu, it does feel like it's been your life mission in the last 2 years to try and see your sister, visit your sister. What are you going to do now? What steps are you taking to ensure that, you know, this time round you actually do get that visa? Do you feel like there are things that are within your control that you can do to maximize your chances?
I'm going to work with an agent this time. There's reason why they are called agents. They see these things. They know why people get rejected even after submitting the required documents. So I think I'm going to work with an agent this December when I apply for it again.
I think I'm rooting for you. Thanks, Lulu.
Thank you.
Oluchukwu Okeke there. So why are so many visa applications from African applicants rejected? My colleague Audrey Brown has been speaking to an immigration consultant.
My name is Willis Makolal, based in Nairobi and working for Fragomen. Why is it more difficult for individuals to move, even though you have, you know, the right credentials? Because we do know that more visas are rejected from African applicants than other groups.
The number of reasons that makes individual moves difficult. Let's take an example of somebody moving from Africa into Europe as individuals. There is a perceived risk of overstaying. The idea is when you want to move from a low-income, say, economy to a high-income economy, everybody who looks at your type of move would think you're going to look for opportunities. And so it becomes very difficult from the adjudication perspective, because they want to look at if this person enters, say, country X in Europe, will they be out of Europe by the time they're saying they'll be there? Even if they're saying they're coming for holiday for a month, would they actually be willing to move back to Africa within the month? And so it is perceived that if you're moving from a low economy to a higher one, then you're going to look for opportunities. And most of these opportunities are actually illegal opportunities, because when they get to land in the whatever countries they're going, then they say, let me look for something to do. And definitely they'll get them, because the opportunities, some of them are very highly skilled, some of them are very qualified, but then there are no opportunities back at home. So a lot of people would be looking to possibilities of getting things to do out in Europe. So from government perspective and from policy perspectives, the idea is to take care of the national interest first. Taking care of national interest then requires that you also protect the jobs for the nationals before you give opportunities to foreigners.
Not so long ago, we were reporting on African academics, African musicians, African artists being denied visas,
yes,
even though they were being invited here. I'm talking specifically about the UK, and in some cases,
yes,
France was also mentioned in this regard. They had a sponsorship from very well-established organizations and institutions. They were able to prove perfectly they had ties back home. They had aging parents. They had children in school.
Mm-hmm.
They had jobs to go back to. They had the money that they needed. And they were still turned away. So I'm just wondering, given the fact that so many Africans, higher than other groups around the world, are being turned away, you can't tell me that prejudice doesn't come into it.
It ends up being the matter of how was the application.
I mean,
yes,
I find it difficult to accept that you would deny that there's prejudice against Africans doing this. Because why then would we have such a high number of people being turned away? Or what a lot of people are thinking is that it's a way of making money for cash-strapped European governments. It's an easy way to do this because they know that people come into these countries. They want to come and do the things that they need to do because it's part of personal development. It's part of sharing and so on. So these are soft touches and easy targets to squeeze money out of.
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say that again with authority, because if you look at, like I said, immigration, visa processing and adjudication is by and large a security process. So even if I've been to the UK 3 or 4 times, and then the 5th time they say, now you're not entering, and unless they give me a reason specific to them saying no, most of the times the governments of the host country would reserve the right to admit or not to admit. So I don't think it's about money or making money.
They do make a lot of money, though, out of the process. And also they reserve,
yes,
the right not to tell you why they denied your entry. In fact, they don't tell you, and they don't have,
yes,
an adjudication process either in many cases. They turn you away and that's it. And they tell you you can apply again without giving you reasons why they turned you down in the first place. Because you're part of an established firm. Does that not happen with individuals that you represent?
No, it never happens with individuals that we represent, because what we do is to go by the rules as stated.
Willis Makolale is immigration consultant and director for Fregomen, an immigration consultancy firm. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm former Wales international footballer Robert Earnshaw, and in Copper Bullets, a new 4-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, I'm exploring how my birth country, Zambia, overcame the devastating loss of their national football team in 1993.
Zambia has had its biggest blow ever in the history of the country.
I kept asking myself, how do we honor these people?
We had to rise from the ashes.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
New research has found that several African countries could meet all their energy needs from floating solar panel systems. Scientists found that Ethiopia and Rwanda are amongst the countries that could achieve this. My colleague Audrey Brown spoke to researcher Alona Armstrong, who explained how the floating solar panels work.
So tell us how these floating energy platforms will work, but first start by describing them to us. I'm seeing sort of huge pads floating around on a relatively small lake.
Yep, so floating photovoltaic systems are essentially kind of PV panels that are mounted or on some form of kind of floating systems. There's both specifically developed floats by companies that have been designed with the intention of floating PV panels. And there's also other systems where they've used pontoons that you might use for jetties or other such things. And then they've had the frames that are used to mount PV panels on roofs or on the ground for those land-based systems.
What's PV?
So that's the technology by which solar radiation is collected and then converted into electricity.
So how are they tethered then? Because they won't just be floating, right? They would be attached in some way.
I've seen some examples in Southeast Asia where they're actually the PV panels are mounted on poles. So I guess they're quite shallow water bodies. But I think on the whole, they're floated on some form of float system. And then they're either tethered in place by anchors in the water body bed. So that might be something like a concrete block or like a corkscrew kind of tether, or they'll be attached to the shore somehow.
They don't need to be floating on water, right? They can just be, you know, posted and hoisted on a huge big pole. What's different about them being on water?
A lot of PV panels are either built out in fields or they'll be on rooftops. But the good things about putting them on water is that they avert land use pressure. So, for example, I think it was the first commercial system which was deployed at a winery in California in 2008. They chose to put it on the water body because if they put it on land, they'd have to rip out vine and their butts and vines, and therefore their production value would go down and their income could go down. So they chose to put it on the water body. The other benefit of it as well is that because it covers the water surface to some degree, it can reduce evaporation, so it can reduce water loss. And then the other thing people have found, that floating on water means the panel is cooler and they're more efficient if they're cooler. So they produce more electricity per panel floated on water versus a land-based system next door.
Your study found particularly that Ethiopia and Rwanda could generate more energy than their current national energy need from these floating energy systems alone. Tell me, how would they do that?
The factors that control that is the amount of water that's suitable to have floating solar on, and also the total power demand of that country. Countries with lots of water area and low power demands will meet more or exceed.
So would this be countries that are surrounding lakes specifically? Because if you put them out to sea, they may be subject to too many destructive forces, shall we say, and rivers might not offer enough space.
Yeah, so they are put on oceans, and there's, you know, even an example, one of the North Sea, which is pretty rough, but a lot of the kind of marine systems are perhaps kind of in lagoons and places where wave action is less rough. Things like putting them on rivers could be more challenging kind of engineering wise, whereas for water bodies, it's probably a bit simpler.
The continent is going through periods of extreme drought and other extreme weather conditions. If the water levels in lakes are affected, would it diminish the efficiency of these floating solar panels?
I guess there's a few things to consider there. So if the water level just varies a bit, I believe that there are anchoring kind of technologies that can account for that, so that would be fine. If the water body dried up completely, you can have systems that are designed to rest on the dry bed. The angle might not be optimal for producing power, but they would still produce, but potentially a little bit less. And the other thing that would happen if the water body dried up is that the panels would lose that cooling effect from the water, so they'd produce a bit less power.
I mean, is it straightforward, or are there actually issues that where some countries might be able to do them and others won't?
Policy is a key challenge, you know, whether in Africa or on other continents, and getting the right policy environment and potentially incentives there is critical. From my perspective as an environmental scientist, the rate of deployment has been very rapid, and improving understanding of what that might mean for the water systems and the other things that water body might supply to people and nature is really important to understand and to be aware of.
Climate, water and energy environmental scientist Alona Armstrong speaking to my colleague Audrey Brown. Now, Ghana recently installed their own floating solar panel system in one of its reservoirs, making it the first country in Africa to do so. But how effective has it been? I called up someone who might know. Alan Jomo Sapong, Greater Accra Coordinator for Friends of Rivers and Water Bodies.
Help us understand more about these floating solar panels in Ghana. Where are they and how is the project, all projects, faring on so far?
The floating panels idea was first introduced in Ghana. That was 2019 by one of national power producers, which is We Power Authority. They initially started with hydropower with 400 megawatts. And then when the idea of introducing the floating panels came, they started with 1 megawatt and then they later added 4 megawatts. So they have 4 megawatt floating solar panel system, which is generating for 5 megawatts power for the national grid. And in terms of our power use, that is not significant. But looking at it from the point of our ability to be able to integrate hydropower with the floating solar panel. Also looking at it from the point of where the world is going today, everybody is talking about renewable energy sources. It's a good start. They are even planning of adding more. So, I mean, they are talking about adding 10 more and then looking up scaling it up, which will have a great input.
Okay. I was wondering in terms of real life, could it power a village? What could it help?
Can power almost a whole region in Ghana, which has a population of maybe 100,000 or so.
So there are some experts then that have argued that these floating solar panels could harm or could cause some harm to aquatic life, while others say it's positive and allows the ecosystem to be restored and prevents evaporation, for instance. What's your stand on this argument?
Yeah, so, I mean, it has a potential. We've not seen it yet. The panels will prevent a direct sunshine to, as it were, hit the water or the river or the water body, which may have a certain kind of effect on the aquatic life. And also, if the panels are not of quality material, it can also degrade, which can also has the potential of also contaminating the water body.
And how is Ghana then managing the potential negative effects of this?
Process of acquiring the panels was very, very robust. And the materials that were used were also solid and quality material. So that is to this point. But as I said, we are new. We've started. So we will not know what will happen in years to come. But there are monitoring and evaluation going on. So if there are any potential dangers, it will be averted. And also, it is largely limited to the dam, which is already producing hydropower. So it has not stretched beyond that dam.
Right. Let's talk about the community impact then. There are people that argue if you put solar panels on land, you might have to displace people, you might have to interrupt livelihoods. Are there any potential positive impacts of having these solar panels over a water body and instead of land? And what could that mean to a fishing community, for instance?
For land, yes. I mean, Bui Dam has also, they have solar panel on the land, which a lot of farmers were displaced, communities, and so on and so on, and then distractions to our forest cover. So to that extent, yes, it is good. But when it comes to the fishing folks, they don't go on the already existing hydro dam. So they are not affected in any way. But if it's extended beyond the hydro dam, then it will affect other land uses, recreation and fishing. But we are not there yet.
Alan Jomo Sapong from Ghana. This episode of Focus on Africa was produced by Susan Gashohe, Frenny Joey, Sunita Nahar, Bella Hassan, Nyasha Michelle and Patricia Whitehorn. Paul Bachbinga steered the production, and Jonathan Greer was a technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Speak again soon.
Hi, I'm former Wales international footballer Robert Earnshaw. And in Copper Bullets, a new four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, I'm exploring how my birth country, Zambia, overcame the devastating loss of their national football team in 1993.
Zambia has had its biggest blow ever in the history of the country.
I kept asking myself, how do we honor these people?
We had to rise from the ashes.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.